Welcome to Mental Illness in Pop Culture. Today we're going to be talking about two Nebraskas that involve two Bruces. The first, the album Nebraska by Bruce Springsteen, and also the film Nebraska, directed by Alexander Payne, starring Bruce Dern. I'm Scott.
I'm Joe.
And we would like to welcome our guest podcaster, Ethan Connor.
Hi, I'm Ethan.
Ethan, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I just graduated from Vanderbilt University. I was a math major. I'm currently working as a computer science consultant, and I just landed a job and I'm moving to Arkansas. Also, I am Scott's son.
Yes.
And the new web development head of the Mental Illness and Pop Culture podcast.
So, glad to have you, and just call me the Eddie Van Halen / Rick Nielsen of podcasting.
Did your dad give you that job?
Yeah. So our original plan was to, and still is, to talk about the movie Nebraska. And as we talked about that at the end of our last podcast, I had people contact me saying, well, if you're going to talk about that Nebraska, it's actually quite related to Nebraska by Bruce Springsteen. So let's start out talking about that. And Ethan, I understand that while you were at Vanderbilt, you took a class on Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, the class was actually Elvis, Dylan, Springsteen, Body, Mind, and Soul. So the idea that conceptually Elvis freed the body of America, Dylan's freed the mind of America, and Springsteen's freed the soul of America.
I'd argue Little Richard freed the body, but
that's
save that for another podcast.
Yeah, and so why was Springsteen considered the soul?
Generally, you go to a Springsteen concert, and it's almost a religious experience. So it's the idea that it had come after a lot of genuine music, after a lot of disco, and what true rock and rollers felt was radio noise, white noise. And so Springsteen comes along, and he puts the heart back into rock. He was this figure who had never taken a real job, and the prototypical I'm going to make it as a musician kind of guy really translated. I know there was a piece written by one of the members of The Who that had talked about he had never felt the connection to the people around him at a Springsteen concert.
That's totally true. I've been lucky enough to go to a couple of Springsteen shows, and one that was really interesting. The first time I ever saw him live, the 2004 election.
I saw the
Vote for Change.
Yeah.
The Vote for Change tour. The leg that I saw had R.E.M. and Springsteen. R.E.M. and Springsteen both were somewhat religious experiences, mm-hmm. or at least there was definitely that revivalist feeling runs throughout both of their shows. And I was like, Springsteen and R.E.M.? Well, that doesn't make sense. Until I realized, because the night performed by Patti Smith being a huge influence on Michael Stipe. But they both were like these revivalist preachers, and Stipe was this thin, tall, wiry, kind of loosey-goosey figure, while Springsteen is this short, stocky, prototypical working man image, and it was a damn good show all the way around.
Yeah, and it wasn't actually until you told me about that class, Ethan, and I started to listen to that in Bruce's music, and the religious metaphors, they are just
dripping
throughout, you know, going to the promised land. And I always kind of felt that Born in the USA was sort of like Nebraska, but to rock music. And I was wondering what your thoughts are about the album Nebraska.
So it really hits me with a Guthrie vibe. Springsteen kind of toning down, especially coming after a couple albums after his Born to Run, which was that huge wall of sound, Spectre sound. And so he tunes down Nebraska. It's also homage to his hometown roots. So he's got the Atlantic City and that New Jersey feeling, which, you know, he was very proud of. His first album, he did the Greetings from Asbury Park, when generally at that time you'd put a picture of your face so people knew what you looked like. Nebraska as a whole, you know, it's got that sadness. It really coincides with the movie well, because when I listen to Nebraska, somehow I hear it in black and white. I don't know if that's a thing you can do.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Well, the cover art is black and white.
Yeah.
And, you know, with like these, you know, red line highlights. And when I listen to Nebraska, to me, it feels like American melancholia. You know, it's dark and it's depressing to a certain degree, only because I think Springsteen, like very few others, really has a way of tapping into the reality of being a working class person or even a low income person in the United States, stripping away all avarice and all vanity, getting at who people really are.
To me, there's kind of a complex authenticity to it. It's stark. It starts out with that sort of lonely, wailing harmonica note, and that leads us into, I'm not sure if all 10 songs, but almost all, are first person narrated. And it's a very kind of plain spoken, authentic language and kind of haunting. And then there's that melancholia, but there's also an underlying sense of hope.
Yeah, lyrically, I think like The Sound itself is probably the saddest album, but lyrically, I don't think it's as sad as like Darkness on the Edge of Town, which, you know, is that dichotomy contrast between Born to Run and Darkness of escape and being trapped. For me, it's worth noting that the first time I really heard Atlantic City was by the band. And so I really enjoy contrasting the southern, bluesy, rocky sound of the band's Atlantic City on Jericho with Springsteen's stripped acoustic. He has a way of putting the words where you don't expect them. Where you would generally expect the rhythm of the words to go, he just sort of lays them out for you. So it's almost a spoken track with music behind it.
Nebraska, the song, is about Charles Starkweather, right?
Yes.
Charles Starkweather murdered the parents of his 14-year-old girlfriend, right? That story inspired the film Badlands by Terrence Malick. And if you've seen Badlands, not to get really film geek about it, but maybe that's a part of the show, there are a lot of shots of just the landscape, the stark landscape of Badlands, which, if I'm not mistaken, is where a lot of Nebraska is actually filmed.
That is correct.
So there's that thread that goes through there.
I guess we would call them the two main characters, Woody and Davey. I think that they travel through the Badlands.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stopping by Mount Rushmore, which is a classic scene.
Yes.
Doesn't look finished.
Lincoln doesn't have an ear. Well, I want to see if the tracks on Nebraska were originally recorded just as the demo. Like, what we're hearing is the actual demo. And Bruce recorded it just on a cassette. And he was walking around with it, just a cassette without a case or cover, in his shirt pocket for like a week before he listened to it and it became the album.
I just want to put out a pet peeve of mine with Springsteen. He didn't get his license until he was like 25, 26. So after he's put out all these albums about cars and about like the feeling of freedom that a car has, he wasn't even driving. It's the most inauthentic authenticity. I just want to put that out there. If we're talking about Springsteen, I want to go on record saying that.
But but he's also from the East New Jersey, not too terribly far away from New York City, and I think the sensibility about automobiles on the coast, or particularly the East, is a lot different than definitely in the Midwest or even out West. And, you know, it's interesting that this film is ultimately, you know, a prototypical road buddy movie.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, even though the choice in cars is definitely not all that seductive, you know, it's really hardscrabble, you know, straightforward working mm-hmm. car without a lot of frills, is this notion of no frills that runs through Springsteen's music. It's all over this film, mm-hmm. you know, because the first thing that you notice about the film Nebraska, like the album Nebraska, is the artwork, the art decoration is all in black and white. And I think that black and white, the stark reality of black and white is it just hits you in the face. Like, this is going to be a different kind of story, you know, so get ready, you know, put your seatbelt on. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Absolutely. And just to follow up on that, so just as the film opens, what do we hear but that lone, longing harmonica note, and then it kind of goes into a lilting melody. And we see sort of a dotty old man walking along the highway, stopped by a cop on his way to the town of Lincoln, Nebraska.
Which is about a 13-hour drive from Billings, Montana, where the film starts. I had to Google that.
So as we kind of transition into talking about the film, I wanted to bring up some of the potential mental health issues that we might end up discussing. First, of course, there's age-related cognitive impairment. As Woody is getting older and seems forgetful and people are questioning his judgment and he seems a little out of it a lot of the time. There's something about the rural Midwest that is a character in this film and how it's portrayed. There's also some really interesting family dynamics going on within the nuclear family of Woody, his wife Kate, two sons, Davey and Ross. Ross, played by Bob Odenkirk, who's amazing in everything he's in. So there's those family dynamics, and then once they get to Hawthorne on the way to Lincoln, then we kind of see issues related to the larger extended family, and then we also find out information about Woody's past. And there kind of comes to be an existential aspect to the film.
Yeah, highly.
Before we start, just some information. So the city of Billings is about 100,000 people. The city of Hawthorne was shot in Plainview, Nebraska, which had a population of about 1,200. So that's what I expect the population of Hawthorne would be. And the surrounding cities near Hawthorne are all equal population or less. So this isn't like a smaller town next to a large town. This is a small town that has to be self-sustaining.
Yeah, this is kind of the hub of that area.
To put it in perspective, some of the towns near Hawthorne were 50 people. So I don't even know if that warrants the name town.
Right.
Yeah, and although we've gotten this far, I will say, spoiler alert, we are going to talk about the things that happen right up until the end. So to pick back up with Woody, played by Bruce Dern, he has received a letter in the mail saying, congratulations, you have won $1 million, provided you return this letter with magazine subscriptions to this address in Lincoln, Nebraska. And different people find out about that along the way. The first is his son, Davey. Davey tries to convince him that it's a sham. There's a little interaction with the family. And then we get to see Davey in his work setting, where he works selling stereo equipment. And I don't know if this is an Easter egg, but I thought it was interesting that the song playing in the stereo shop was Fool for the City by Foghat, kind of reflecting on Woody. So what we kind of come to see, Davey, we kind of see a parallel life between Woody and Davey. Initially, they both seem kind of like losers. Davey's girlfriend just broke up with him and he lets his plants die. Davey says, all right, I'm going to take you with, or I'll take you to Lincoln. So I'm curious what you thought about that. Like, why would a son, knowing that this is a sham, why would he go on this road trip with his dad?
I felt like it was, on one hand, Will, he didn't have anything else to do. You know, he's kind of reeling from the breakup of this two-year relationship. But I think the bigger issue is, I don't think it was so much that he wanted to show his dad up so much as he just wanted to do whatever it took to just put it to bed. And he knew that if he didn't drive his dad to all the way to Lincoln, Nebraska, his dad was never going to believe that $1 million wasn't his.
Yeah, and we...
Yeah, how about the son telling his father?
Well, we see throughout the movie that Woody's fixation with this $1 million gets him hurt, physically injured. And I think Davey recognizes that early on, that this is going to get my dad killed if I don't put a stop to it, and this is the be-all, end-all way to put a stop to it. I think that not just Davey's lackluster personal life, but the fact that he's in a job where he can just take that time off, as compared to Ross, who has just started anchoring the evening news and who is very invested in his career, as well as apparently his family, who we don't ever see, but we get several mentions of.
So in addition to that, there's a scene a little later where Davy and Woody have stopped in Hawthorne, and they're staying with Woody's older brother, I think Ray, and and Ray's wife, and the cousins, the twins. Kate, the mom, she joins them at a bus stop. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting scene because Kate says, you know, she's just really dismissive and she tends to be pretty dominant in the family. She says to Davy, you know, why are you doing this? And he says, it's about how much longer is he going to be around? What's the harm in letting him have his little fantasy for a couple more days? Davy has started to kind of get into it. Got a couple theories that I'll introduce here. One I'm going to call the Cervantes theory, that I majored in Spanish long ago, and I read Don Quixote. I don't remember very much of it, but I do remember that there's this kind of dotty old man, but he wants to believe that he's a knight, and he's got his sidekick, Sancho Panza, which I think Davy really kind of plays that. There's this sort of broken down horse, Rocinante, that they're riding on, which is just like the car that they're riding in. There's this woman who is a prostitute, but in Don Quixote's mind, he makes her into Dulcinea, the most beautiful woman in the world. There gets to be something about why it's important to believe in something even when you know it can't possibly be true. And even when I think of the musical based on Don Quixote, the theme song, To Dream the Impossible Dream, just seemed to resonate with this a lot. In Don Quixote, we are aware throughout the novel that his death is imminent, which I think we can say about Woody too. I'll stop there. I'll get into my death theme after later.
That's deep. Well, you know, I think it does. I mean, the metaphor and the connections definitely fit. And I was really struck by the idea of time and the passage of time. My mom always tells me that she's got more days behind her than ahead of her.
Yeah.
You know, and I felt like throughout every moment in the film, there was this constant reflection, going back and seeing Woody's old home, going to the bar that he used to hang out in, going to the garage that he used to own. You know, everything was so, for lack of better terms, retro. The only hope for the future that he had in his head was this winning ticket, this phantom winning ticket. It seemed to be the motivator to wake up the next day, because there are several scenes in the film where he's just needling his son. When are we going? When are we leaving? When, you know, are we getting back on the road? When are we going to be in Lincoln? Because to look back at the past, I don't know how you guys felt, but his extended family members and the people in town were just snakes and vultures. And they just, it didn't seem like a happy place. It didn't seem like a return to happy memories. You know, he didn't come back to Hawthorne as a hero. Came back as kind of a joke. And he had to really grapple with that. And that must be really difficult for someone who's in their 70s, in their 80s, to look back at all that history and see where you are now and just wonder to yourself, what happened? But we know what happened, well, at least partly what happened for him.
He didn't want to go back to Hawthorne when he's arguing with Davy. He tells him that. And I think the lack of desire to go back to Hawthorne has less to do with what it is now and more to do with the memories that he left there when he left. We get these very obvious conversations where people are saying, your father was such a good man, Woody was always so kind. And Kate discusses it in her arguments with the family when that comes to a head.
Best scene of the film.
Oh my gosh. Oh,
best scene. She's amazing.
You're like not liking her, not liking her, not liking her, and then suddenly.
Love her.
Yeah, suddenly, this is why we need her.
Yeah. And you realize why he needs her.
Yes.
Because, I mean, she says throughout the film, he would do anything for anybody. He can't say no to people. And since his character is so quiet and somewhat withdrawn and and really interior. There she is, loud, bawdy, boisterous, and just a force to be reckoned with. She was not going to let anybody screw him over. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a really beautiful thing to see.
As we're talking about Woody looking back on his life, this is really, if you study lifespan development and Eric Erickson's stages of where we are at various points in the life, and we have tasks to overcome. And this would be the final stage, which is called ego integrity versus despair. What that amounts to is, as people look back on their life, they need to feel that their life has been worthwhile, that they've accomplished and contributed, and that they matter, or they will be stuck in despair. We can really see that with Woody, and I think he is somewhat in despair for the majority of the movie.
I would say throughout the whole thing. I mean, even as they're driving off into the sunset, so to speak, before the final credits roll, I think he had a moment of satisfaction that he was able to show them up, especially
Ed Pegram.
Yeah, especially Ed. And Ed was a prick.
Yeah.
And he deserved everything he got in the film. But beyond that, it was kind of clear that Woody wasn't happy. And when he explaining to Davey that, you know, his motivation for why it's so important for him to go and try to claim this prize so that he can have something to leave for his sons, you know, that kind of indicates that at one point he knows that he had things, and then for whatever reasons, which clearly there's a host of them, he lost it all, you know, and now he's just one last ditch effort to do something great for my family, you know, is what's going through his head. And so I don't think he ever really gets past that, because he's got to realize that ultimately the prize people did not give him that truck. But you know, sees that, you know, he did something right to have a son that could be that self-sacrificing, to not only go on this wild goose chase in the first place, but upon finding the result of the wild goose chase, doing everything that he could to make his dad feel okay about it, you know. That was pretty powerful.
So I want to return to Ed Pegram in a minute, but first I want to talk about Woody and the realizations that you talked about. So I was actually under the impression that he doesn't realize that his son bought the truck. So throughout the movie, we see him in demented fixation, where because of the degradation within his mind, the deterioration of his mind, he is fixating on this $1 million, and there's absolutely no way that anyone can tell him it's different. It's impossible to change his mind because he's formed that neural connection, and it just can't be unformed at this point, which I have personally experienced with my elderly grandparents. So he has this fixation, and I think he's not seeing Davy's contributions and the driving as a sacrifice as much as he thinks it's someone finally getting on board with. I do think somewhere he realizes that it's all a sham, but I only feel that way because when he goes there, he gives up so easily when they tell him he doesn't have $1 million. And I don't know if that, I'm curious if that's as to his deep-seated knowledge that this really wasn't ever going to work, or that's just his dementia nature saying, well, I can't, I just am too weak to fight, and that's why he thinks that Davey had made a deal with Publishers Clearing House for reference people. But on Ed Pegram.
Wait, before you go on.
Yeah, hold on.
Sorry. Whoa. I think that when we get more of Woody's backstory, we can start to see that definitely he is waning and there is deterioration going on. But we also see where some of this all came from and how there's some learned, almost as a survival mechanism. So he was shot down and living with Kate. And of course, we love that scene. But she is on him, on him, on him. And there are times where we can see him intentionally not hearing what she's saying.
Yeah, definitely.
Like in the cemetery. Where she's just...
That's the best.
Oh.
Anyway.
But you gave up because you talked about pot too much. It's like, yes.
And being taken advantage by everybody and the drinking. And I think that those factors all together, that there's this learned behavior. I do think in the final drive through town, even when in the finding the teeth scene that he's regaining, like in the finding the teeth scene, I think he takes his place as a parent again. Because Davey thinks he's getting one over on Woody, but then Woody puts it right back in his face. And that's just what the joke about this could be your whose teeth he's
in. Well, I mean, that kind of makes me ask, especially about either full-blown dementia or these, you know, fugue states are seniors can have from time to time. Could having those kinds of things happen to you cause two realities to be playing out at the same time? So a reality in which, on one hand, he's definitely dedicated to getting this prize money. And on the other hand, he's also somewhat aware that he's not going to get the prize money and his son is making these sacrifices. And these two different stories, these two completely polar opposite stories kind of colliding with one another and catching flashes here, flashes there, and these strange but logical distortions of reality. Because I felt like that's what the last half hour of the film was, kind of straddling these two things. Because on one hand, you have this entire town of people, you know, applauding him and demanding money from him because they think he's loaded. That's a reality that he's perpetrated. And at the same time, oftentimes in the same space, you have another group of people saying, no, this is not, that's not real. Does not have any money. He hasn't won anything. Which I was always kind of struck with the townspeople because it was like they were saying, we're on our way to claim this. So why was everyone assuming that he already had it and was already wealthy? And it was like, how do we end up playing with reality and what do we choose to believe as a matter of our own conscious choice? And what do we choose to believe as a matter of something more deeply seated as opposed to conscious choice?
I think that's powerful, and it goes back to what you said earlier about belief as a motivation to get going in the morning and to be alive and to do something. And I want to link it back to Dream the Impossible Dream. Now, that's in that song, that is presented as noble, to believe in the impossible. At the end of every hard-earned day, you got to find a reason to believe. Springsteen quote.
So when I looked at Woody and I looked at they talk about all the favors that he did, the impression that I always got is that he devalued his own work. So he didn't place a lot of value in what he did, and he placed so much value in what others did, and that's why he has this really weird respect for Ed Pegram. He always, for some reason, saw Pegram's work as better than his own. I think that's why he gets taken advantage of, because he devalues his work. And when Ross and Davey have that conversation early on, very forced conversation in the dialogue about how Dad never gave a shit about us, that's him devaluing his own work, which are his two sons. And then is it okay to switch over to Pegram now?
I really want to
talk about Ed Pegram. So I wonder how much of what Ed Pegram says about Woody losing customers and botching jobs is true, given his drinking. Because that's a viable scenario, but Woody seemed to have owned a gas station in Billings and done really well and been able to manage that. When Pegram is going through and bullying Woody and trying to get money, I think that he sees Woody as some foolish guy that never worked as hard as I, Ed, did, and who got lucky and struck it rich, and I deserve a piece of that because I always worked harder than he did. That's just the mindset that he's going through. And when Woody comes and takes that letter out of his hand in the bar right before Davey just haymakers him, when Woody comes and takes that paper without saying a word...
I'm not a fan of violence, but...
I think we see in Ed's face this realization that Woody isn't all there, and that he suddenly, it wasn't just like this foolish guy that was always a couple years older than him. It's a man who is nearing the end of his life and has lost his marbles and is sticking to this. And I think in that moment he feels shame. And that's why he stands there and lets Davey punch him. You know that everybody in the room knew that punch was coming. He just stood there and took it. He felt like he deserved that because of that realization that it wasn't fighting against a guy that he knew. It was taking advantage of a man who had lost his sense.
So you're almost arguing for the redemption of Ed Pegram, which I would say that the final scene of him as Woody is driving the car, we see Ed with a shiner just mm-hmm. looking. I mean, I would say that supports what you're saying.
I'm not
trying to say that Ed Pegram wasn't a prick. I'm just trying to give you a sense of what's going through his mind throughout this movie.
I felt like Ed, I mean, if we're keeping a Springsteen theme going, Ed's character reminded me of the song Glory Days, which is not on the Nebraska album, but Ed had that image of the tough guy, the big shot, who's now in his, he's also rapidly approaching his waning years. He's a little bit younger than Wally.
Woody.
I have the character list like right in front of me. But Woody is a little bit older than Ed, but Ed seemed to me to think he was the big shot in town. Mm-hmm. You know, he's sitting at the bar holding court, everybody's laughing along with him, so on and so forth, while they're making fun of Woody and this ticket. And I don't think that he knew he was about to get punched in the face. I don't think anybody in that bar thought that this young guy would disrespect. I mean, if we're really playing out,
yeah,
you know, Midwestern sensibility and ethics, a younger man, you know, clocking an older dude doesn't really happen. He deserved it. This in the last scene when we see Ed, the look that I thought he had on his face was, how'd that son of a bitch get that truck if the money wasn't real, you know, because they don't know mm-hmm. anything that happened in Lincoln. So I felt like a part of Ed's final image was just this pure questioning of reality that he assumes, and now he's not really sure of anything. And, you know, his whole world's kind of topsy-turvy. Maybe.
I
mean, I don't know. That's just, that was just my gut reaction to it.
I love just those long shots, like the camera just held on him.
Yeah.
And the look, and kudos to Stacy Keach, who I thought was excellent in the role.
He's one of the underrated actors.
Ed Pegram.
Ed Pegram, okay. Yeah. And going back to Davey hitting Ed Pegram in the bar, now I want to shift it to Davey's perspective.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because at the beginning, Woody and Davey are portrayed as two generations of losers. Then we get to the tavern scene where Kate's there and they order a meal and Ed sings karaoke. And Kate is just going on and on about how feminine Davey was as a baby. It's really emasculating, which may parallel some of her relationship with Woody. But I felt like Davey was questioning his own identity, his own strength as a person, literally and figuratively, maybe. And I felt like he got himself back with that punch.
Yeah, reclaimed a sense of self. And I'm kind of remiss on saying manhood.
Yeah, same here.
You know, I don't think that physical violence is what demarcates manhood. But I think in that moment, it was the fact that he stepped up and defended the honor of his parents. And that's what made him a man, or at the very least, an adult.
Well, an adult, yeah.
You know, and in the sense of the small town, violence does sort of correlate in their own eyes to manhood. I don't want to say that I'm a small town expert, but I have quite a lot of experience. And that's also one of the things I wanted to bring up, alcohol's role in the movie. So we talked about Woody's alcoholism, which I think is poorly portrayed, because in the very first stop that they make, when Davey has to run in and find him at the bar, he leaves half of his beer unfinished on the table, which I don't think somebody who's actually an alcoholic would be okay with, but that's just that may not be true. Alcohol in this movie, I think, is a symbol for manhood, especially in Woody's eyes. And that's probably why he gave them sips of beer when they were six. And we have this conversation where Woody goes, come on, have a beer with your old man, for that, like, you're not being a man, you're not being my son.
When Davey goes and has the conversation with Peg at the newspaper. And he asked her, and she tells him that they were a couple. She described it as ancient history. And Davy was asked the question, you know, was he drinking back then? And her response was, well, yeah, I mean, but there was nothing to do. Everybody was.
Yeah, it's just cornfields and bottles of cheap liquor.
Yeah. And that kind of, because Woody would claim a couple of times in the film that he wasn't an alcoholic. He didn't see himself as an alcoholic. And when he dresses down Davy for trying to tell him that he drinks too much, et cetera, et cetera, it was a tough scene because it was like, is he telling them that because he's in denial? Or is he telling them that because he knows for himself the difference between an alcoholic and alcohol being a part of the culture?
Because it is a huge part of the culture to the point where it's daily. To an extent, if you're not from a small town, you can understand that. But I think there is just something about small town alcoholism. So I come from a town of 2,700 people, and there are no businesses that can make it on the main street. There are 5 bars in town that are thriving.
Yeah,
not to use anecdotal evidence. I just want to disclaim.
Well, I mean, and it's a definitely, if not a working class phenomenon, a Midwestern phenomenon as well. Riding around the back roads on a Friday or Saturday night, you know, when you're in high school or just out of high school, drinking beers with your buddies, male and female.
And Mom, if you're listening, I never did that, for the record.
I think my mom knew I did, so.
But you had friends, people talk.
Right, oh yeah.
You know, I mean, those are, you know, activities that are just a part of things. And so it's like, I think the film does a really phenomenal job with getting inside a particular culture from a particular time, looking back on itself.
I want to go back to your question about, can he have different beliefs about alcoholism and himself. And I think it's like what you had said even earlier, related to the winning ticket, that he both believes and doesn't believe. The topic of alcoholism, as talked about, and the actual sharing of beer, it goes through a transition throughout the film. So it goes from Davy condemning Woody to Davy drinking one beer with him. And then it winds up, hey, you want to go in there? You want to have some beer? And then Davy seems to be encouraging it. Similar to Davy encouraging the belief or the going along to Lincoln to get the ticket, he's only got a little bit of time left. You know, let's make the most of it. Woody ends up saying, well, what if I am an alcoholic? So what?
I pay my taxes.
Right. I mean, it's a hard question.
Yeah.
Especially at his point of his life that he's at, where he's going to, either way, he's going to die soon.
And the second half of Peg's comment about drinking being was that today it's all the other stuff. That's a problem, which of course is at the tip of the hat to crystal meth and opioid, and just even kind of stratifying these sins, so to speak, you know, these addictions. It's like, well, yeah, we got a lot of drinkers around here, but there's a difference between them compared to
the tweakers.
Yeah.
and that was one of the issues I had with the movie, is that in a town like that, there's no such thing as an abandoned house that's not a meth house. There's just really not. I've seen it firsthand. So the fact that they're able to just magically come back to Woody's old house and it's just still standing and everything's like it was, it's just kind of broken in and there's some dirt everywhere. It felt great in the movie. I felt like it gave Woody some of his most lucid moments, but very unbelievably unrealistic.
I know that you have anecdotal evidence, so I'll take you at your word. But as a cinematic motif, I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And it was, again, Davy getting new information about Woody, and they gained such a greater respect. And it's all part of Woody getting his dignity back, too. Like, understanding Woody was there with his 2-year-old brother, who died. His 2-year-old brother named
David,
whom Davy was named after, and that Woody's father built that house by himself.
Yeah.
That was a powerful scene. I also thought it came directly from my father's house on Nebraska.
So that actually gave what I think is my favorite scene from that movie, where right before they leave, Woody is standing looking out over the corn. He's just looking. And so to me, I think he's like running through all these memories that he had, because I know that people with dementia have better memory of earlier memories. So they're nodding their heads yes, for those of you at home.
Yeah, so I mean, you can see us so clearly.
So Davey walks up to him and says, "Did you ever want a farm like your dad?" And Woody takes a moment and says, "I don't remember," and takes another moment and says, "It doesn't matter." And so I think the first part of that I don't remember is him attempting to hide the memory and rationalize it away as being like, "Oh, I can't remember because of my dementia." But I think he does remember, and I get the sense that he did want to do that, and that's why he says, "It doesn't matter anyway, because I'm too old to correct the mistakes that I made, and I'm too old to do the things I want to do." And so... so that was very powerful to me, to see him, because we see him multiple times when Pegram talks about the affair that he had, where he had desires and he had emotions that he didn't act upon, and now at the end of his life he's reflecting.
Actually, Davey ends up respecting Woody even more for just what you're saying, Ethan, of seeing his father more as a human and who he once was, maybe when he was Davey's age.
Yeah, because we have that scene where Davey's unsure if he wants to marry this girl, and Woody is just not helpful at all. Like, "Oh, you know, your mother wanted to, and I didn't care, and I didn't really expect to have kids, but I like to screw, and she was Catholic, you do the math." And we see how much that hurts Davey, so it probably pains him to hear that his father had an affair. I do agree that it's nice to hear that he cares, which brings me back to Peg, who I want to talk about as a literary trope, because I see her as the sage of the story, where the hero Davey comes to her not knowing what to expect. By the way, the Hawthorne Republican, a hint of like small town Midwest vibes. So he comes to her not knowing what to expect and just to explain, and he ends up being given knowledge and wisdom and understanding about the journey that he's on, which is understanding his dad. And so I thought that was really interesting discussion, because that's really not what I expected from that scene of him trying to explain to the newspaper that his dad's not a millionaire, is for him to come away like armed with that knowledge.
With newfound appreciation. She was the one who said how kind Woody was to everyone.
Yeah, I was expecting her to be, you know, a sharp journalist. I'm going to try to get the best, juiciest story that I can possibly get. And she ends up being really warm and reflective and caring person. The way that Peg talks about Woody and Kate, she won. You know, it's okay though, because I went on to marry a wonderful man. We built this newspaper together, and he died recently, and we had three kids. And you know, it's again, it's this constant going back and looking at these moments in life that become our iconic memories. What are the memories that take you all the way to the end? And I feel like that's like a major theme that runs through the entire text of the film. What are these big moments? Davey, right in the first 5 minutes of the film, is dealing with a big moment. His girlfriend's moved out. Girlfriend he's been with for 2 years moves out. We never really get a clear reason why, although we can kind of get the sense that he's waffling and he's not being really serious, and perhaps he has more of his old man in him than he would feel comfortable with at the time.
Yeah. You know, this generational parallel between Woody and Davey. Yeah. There's even the scene in that bus scene where Kate first arrives, and she says to Davey, "Oh, you're going to be just like your old man." And the shot is a profile of both of them. They are just same profile with same type of coat on. And
yeah. Payne does that a lot. It's one of his signatures. He's had similar shot construction in Election and Sideways. He doesn't rely on special effects or anything like that. He just tells a solid story and shoots it as straightforward as possible without a whole lot of frills. I don't want to call it stark. It's definitely efficient filmmaking, but it does have a certain simplicity to it that both the state of Nebraska has, the Springsteen album has, you know,
yeah,
this whole project is just stamped with simplicity. Which we didn't even say the biggest connection between the Springsteen album and the film is the fact that Payne grew up in Nebraska, and the album Nebraska is one of his favorite records. I mean, he really puts you there. He makes you feel like you are in the back seat of that car, or you're standing right behind line, Davey.
That last bit where they're driving in the pickup and it's from the back seat, I could actually feel myself in the car, like mentally, just because of that view. The last shot also gives the viewer just a moment to process what's gone on in the scene, whereas you don't have to, mentally, you don't have to jump to a new scene, you don't have to ready yourself for that. You can just, for a moment, you can think, and that adds power to the movie itself because you come away from it having reflected on it more than when you're pushed. The parallels and the contrast between Kate and Davey's girlfriend, because, you know, both Woody and Davey were faced with similar choices in their life on, like, what do I do? And I think that's why Kate and Woody work, because she was forceful and she was just like, you're going to do this. This is what's going to happen. And I think had Davey's girlfriend been more like that, they would still be together. Because she like, leaves it up to him and he doesn't know what to do. And for all the flack that Kate takes throughout the movie, I think that for that personality type, she's really good for that. She keeps them moving. She is the motivator.
It is, I think, but we can presume that Davey's in his early 30s, somewhere around there. He's watching his parents' relationship, and I think he's beginning to see it in very, very different ways, especially getting newfound information from all these town folk, you know, like Peg, and filling in some of these gaps, and that kind of forces him to say, maybe I didn't know as much about my parents' relationship as I thought I did, and begins to see his parents in a much different way. I don't know if in the beginning of the film, Davey would have punched someone in the nose being on that journey with his dad and finding out as much as he did about his parents that he didn't know previously matured him to that point, for lack of better terms.
It's fair to note that this is only like a 4-day journey too. Right. I think they start on a Thursday and five, because they go there on Monday and then they make a full drive back on, or it ends on Monday because they go all the way back to...
They go through Hawthorne and then on the same off day. Into the sunset.
Yeah, so it is a very fast journey.
I want to talk about things related to family dynamics. So we were talking about scenes where you feel like you're right there in the room, and that scene in Hawthorne where they're watching the Bears against the Lions. And it's all the men just kind of sitting there. And
all the women are in the...
I mean, I'm curious what you thought of the portrayals of Midwestern rural characters as represented by the extended family.
So it did kind of feel like a stereotypical get-together. I also think the point in that scene where Ross comes in and everybody looks up from the TV, hey Ross, back to the TV, is very... I don't know if it's telling of just like general family get-togethers, but from what I've experienced and what I've seen portrayed in media, it's a very stereotypical get-together for that age generation. So before Ross gets there, you have Davey sitting there, his two cousins, who are fools, for lack of a less appropriate term, who are, it's never clear what they do for work. Obviously, one of them has a sexual assault charge that he's going against. So it's almost not worth talking to these people. Like, were it me, I certainly wouldn't want to talk to those two goons. And there's not much you can converse with the rest of the guys. It's easier to sit in silence than to exert yourself and feel like gain nothing from it.
And there was the scene then with Phoebe and Woody and Kate ordering dinner. And Woody is thinking about meatloaf, but Kate tells him it's not on the menu. So he asks the waitress, she says, we don't have it. He says, well, then I'll have chicken, which kind is like fried. And then Kate shoots him down. And then Kate asks the waitress, so what's good here? And the waitress says, well, everything's good, but I prefer the tilapia. And she goes, oh, I'll have the pot roast.
Which is a very stereotypical Midwest meal.
Yeah. So we're seeing the dynamics of the relationship between Woody and Kate. And Davey, he says, I'll have the tilapia. He's providing balance, or what we call homeostasis, within the family.
Not to dismiss that point, because that's a really great point. And there were a couple of scenes like that that definitely showed the tensions among the family unit, among the brothers, among husband and wife, among father, son, mother, son. But I'm kind of stuck on the soul stereotype thing.
Okay.
Because I'm not sure of what the difference is, at least when it comes to this film, the difference between stereotype and honest depiction. I went to a university in a really small rural town. And so I've had my travails and my adventures or misadventures, whatever the case may be, in small town America. Those things like big Sunday family dinners, pot roasts, those little dive bars in small towns that hold like 30 people. I've been in those places. So when I was watching the film, even though I had never been to Nebraska, a lot of it felt really familiar in many ways, especially the bar scenes. But what's stereotype and what's, this is a slice of Americana. This is something that really happens. This is what it's like. This is what life is like for a lot of folks in rural Western Nebraska.
Yeah, I had a similar thought, and these depictions did resonate with me. And to a certain extent, the extended family are a little bit of window dressing, and they provide humor. But even the portrayal of Ross and Woody and Kate and Davy, I think, gave a three-dimensional portrayal. And I'm just going to read my note of how I described it to myself. Subtle and stark, like the record Nebraska, filled with authenticity that challenges two-dimensional, romanticized notions of the Midwest as the heartland, God's country, salt of the earth people. And this film shows more complex three-dimensional version of that as whole, real people with pain and fears, wanting to better themselves, even in ways that hurt or take advantage of other people. And needing to hope and believe in possibility, even if that possibility seems unrealistic, because you need to believe to live.
My thoughts on the stereotype versus honest opinion. It didn't even cross my mind that this was a stereotype because it was such an accurate depiction of how I lived. I didn't cross my mind that other people didn't live that way. The Sunday dinners, the taverns, like,
yeah.
Pot roast. Oh God, I love pot roast. Nobody makes better pot roast than Grandma. Yeah, so these were all just all very accurate things. The weirdest thing I thought about the restaurant scene was that this waitress would recommend tilapia at a steakhouse. That
in, was the, what, in the middle
yeah.
of Nebraska,
yeah,
which is about as landlocked as you're going to get. It's like, where'd you get this tilapia?
I sympathized with Kate because I don't think I would order tilapia there.
So let's go to the end.
Yeah.
So let's go to the scene driving through town and into the sunset. And what do you think that represented? Or
there are four characters that we see look at Woody as he's driving. There's
Ed.
There's Ed, obviously. There's
Pam.
Peg. There's Bernie Bowen, who we only see one other time, and that's to approach Woody, and we expect him to ask for money, but he's just like small, smiley, jovial guy. And then we see Uncle Albert.
Yeah, sitting watching the streets.
Bernie is the community. Peg is the sage. Ed is the antagonist. Thank you. Albert is the family. And so we have these different representations of the story through the characters that see Woody. And in a town of 1,200 people, we only see four people look at Woody, and yet he still feels validation. I think that's more because he did it than because people saw it. Because it was always his dream to own a pickup truck.
Or those are the only people that actually mattered in this story. Because maybe I was just imagining this, but I felt like throughout the entire film, there's this recurring idea of your past is becoming out of reach the closer you get to driving off in the sunset. All of these really important things in his life, bar he hung out at, the garage that he worked in, so on and so forth, there was so much that just wasn't there anymore. Part of the reason why you see so few people on the streets in this town. I mean, 1,200 people, I mean, it's small compared to a lot of other places, but 1,200 people is still a lot of people. How many of those people actually matter to his history? Of those people, how many matter? Which is a part of the reason why I was always rather confused about why he claimed he didn't remember dating Peg.
It seems like he really did, but he said that he didn't. I think that was a defense mechanism.
It's another, and he did that
See,
again.
It's that,
he did
it's
that,
that,
again.
That protection of what we think he's just out of it, but we see it's kind of a learned behavior because that would be threatening to Kate and his identity. I thought that Albert might represent Watcher or Angel of Death. The very last words of the movie our Uncle Albert saying, "So long, Woody." I think that there has been foreshadowing throughout the movie that right after what we see, right at the sunset, Woody is going to pass away. So I want to just loop back and wrap up any additional Springsteen references.
We get the scene after the ticket is stolen, after the two cousins mug them. So we get the scene where Davey walks in on his dad sitting alone in the dark kitchen, which is just so Springsteen. Springsteen's father, Doug, was also an alcoholic. Bruce used to talk about, in his biography and the biography Bruce, both talk about Doug just sitting in the kitchen alone drinking, and people would pass him by, and it was like he didn't notice. There seemed to be like no recognition that there were other people in the room, and so they would just leave him alone. And that's immediately what I felt when Woody walked in on his dad, where he's trying to engage with his dad, and his dad is saying absolutely nothing. Then all of a sudden he says, "Do you want to go look for the ticket?" And his dad sprints out the door, which I suppose would be, in this movie, is that ticket. Because that's the motivation, and that's what I think Davey talks about, is like, yeah, this gives him a reason to wake up.
Well, and I want to go back again. You know, I quoted Reason to Believe. I think that's an underlying theme of this movie. And that song, Reason to Believe, you know, it ends this album of melancholia with a sense of hope, dreaming the impossible dream. A couple more references, I thought. The song Used Cars, I think, is really relevant. You know, they buy the used truck, and I'll read a couple lines. "Now, mister, the day the lottery I win, I ain't never gonna ride in no used car again. Now the neighbors come from near and far as we pull up in our brand new used car. I wish he'd just hit the gas and let out a cry and tell them all they can kiss our asses goodbye." And the last one, a line from My Father's House. When Woody and Davey first go up to the auto shop that Ed and Woody used to own, and Woody asks if Ed Pegram still works there, and they say, "No, I'm sorry, there's nobody like that here." And there's a line from My Father's House. She said, "I'm sorry, son, but no one by that name lives here anymore." Plus, the whole scene where Davey takes the family back to the abandoned house, which is where Woody grew up, you don't get much more My Father's House than that.
Yeah.
We should also mention Bruce recently, and it might have just been in the autobiography, Born to Run. By the way, I listened to that audiobook, Bruce reading his own autobiography. Oh my gosh, that was great. But Bruce talks about his own real struggles with depression. And he also talks about his father's struggles. He says he misportrays his father and his songs, and that there were other things going on, one of which he says is schizophrenia. Mm. Let's wrap up this episode.
Okay, yeah. Bruce exhibiting depression is really interesting because he has those really creative manic faces.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can find us on social media. We have a new Facebook page. Please like our Facebook page. By the way, if you are interested in helping us out at all, please write a positive review on your app of choice. We are available on iTunes or whatever you listen to podcasts on. We are also on Twitter, mentalillnessinpopculture@gmail.com. And you can find all of our episodes at mentalillnessinpopculture.podomatic.com. And
we have a brand new Instagram page, Mental Illness and Pop Culture.
Sweet.
And thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
So long, Woody.